We'll call the Senate Tax Committee to order for March 10th, 2015. Morning, members. Senator Tomasoni, Senate File 40. Oh, you know, members, as long as we have a quorum, let's do the minutes. We will take a few minutes to review the minutes of March 5th. They're in your packet.
Move approval, Mr. Chair.
Senator Senjum moves approval of the minutes. Any discussion, members? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Minutes are approved. Thank you. Senator Tomasoni.
Morning, Mr. Chairman, committee members. Senate File 402 is an attempt to correct what I think is an inconsistency in our tax refund laws. Currently, you have to file for a property tax refund by August 15th, and if you are in a situation where you might have filed for an income tax extension, you have until October 15th to do so. So it's there's a two-month lag period. And an accountant from Hibbing contacted me to tell me that what oftentimes happens with his clients is that that they file for an extension for their income tax, and their income tax form is where you get the property tax refund also. And so what ends up happening is they bring in their information to him in September because they know they have until October 15th to file for the extension. And in amongst the information is the property tax refund also, but it's already too late. And so by the time they file for the extension on October 15th, the property tax refund that they would have gotten on August 15th is already late, and so then they don't qualify for the property tax refund. And so what this does is it just makes both the property tax refund and the extension of the income tax the same date, which is October 15th.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Mr. Fragnito.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Gino Fragnito, the Government Relations Director at the Minnesota CPA Society, and the CPAs do support this bill, and we are strong supporters of making the tax code easier and simpler for people to understand and follow, and I think this is a small step to help with that.
Any questions, members? Senator Tomasoni, I am looking at the revenue impact statement. It's $3.4 million.
Yeah, and if that's the case, Mr. Chairman, there's a whole bunch of people that are missing their property tax refunds, and so we should probably do this.
Well, that's
I think they calculate 5,500 people are not getting their refunds. That looks like that's probably about an average of $600 to $700 per person, and there are probably people who need to get these refunds. And so, it just seems to me it makes good sense to do this. And whether or not it's $3.5 million or not, I don't know. But if the revenue note is correct, I would say that there's an awful lot of people who are doing exactly what I just said. Is they're getting an extension on their income tax and forgetting to file their property tax by August 15th, and then they're just not eligible for the property tax refund.
I'm reading the revenue analysis in the detail. It's 5,000 additional tax filers.
And then down at the bottom, there's 5,500 additional property tax refunds to homeowners and renters. Those two numbers are inconsistent, but it seems like some kind of an inconsistency that we probably should correct.
Anything else, members? Anyone else in the audience wish to testify on Senate File number 402? Anybody from the counties or DOR? Seeing nothing, Chair will lay over Senate File 402 for possible inclusion. Thank you, Senator Tomasoni.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee member.
Senator Gazelka. Senator Gazelka, do you have a preference on which one we do first?
Mr. Chair, I'll take, I think, Senate File 354. They're very similar, but...
Yeah. Senate File 354, and I believe there's a couple of amendments. Do you want to put those on first, Senator Gazelka?
Yes. Mr. Chair, there's the same amendment for each one. On Senate File 354, it's the A5 amendment.
It's in the packets.
Members, the A5 is in your packets. Senator Gazelka moves the A5 amendment. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A5 is adopted. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
354 is amended.
This first, both of them are dealing with property tax issues, particularly late payments. I have firsthand knowledge of this this issue. The first one basically makes the penalty the same no matter who you are, whether you're a business, whether you're a resident, the penalty is the same. Right now, a commercial property owner already pays around twice as much property taxes as a resident for the same valued property. When there's a late penalty, they're basically paying double the penalty. So, in effect, four times what it would have been if you were a resident. And so this bill basically makes those two the same. The amendment goes a little bit further and says that if you no penalty under this section shall accrue if the property tax payment is delivered by mail to the county treasurer and the envelope containing the payment is postmarked within 2 business days of the due date prescribed under this section. The reason why I added that on there is today, if you drop a piece of mail in the post office box or post office, in rural Minnesota at least, it doesn't always get postmarked that day. In the Brainerd area, they ship it down to St. Cloud, and that's when they postmark it. And so you don't get the same postmark day as the day you drop it. So if somebody sends their taxes in by mail because they don't want to drive 20 miles to a county courthouse, and they put it in the mail, it no longer guaranteed that that's going to be a postmark date. So then when the county gets it, the postmark date is later, and guess what? They pay that big fee. And so this addresses that as well. And so that's basically this bill. And next to me is Russ Nigren. He's the former Morrison County Auditor Treasurer for 28 years, one of the counties I represent. So I wanted him to be here to give some background on both of these bills, but particularly the second bill.
Well, thank you, Senator Gazelka. I know we've had conversations about this. You had a bill similar to this last year, didn't you?
I've been working on this for a number of years, yes, yeah. Mr. Chair.
Anything, members? Mr. Nigren?
Yes. I appreciate the opportunity to come, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. As an elected official for many years, had to defend a lot of legislation and bills to citizens and explain. And when I became a treasurer 5 years ago and had to try to explain when people walked up to the counter about property tax penalty when the bill doesn't make any logical sense, it was really, really hard for me. And that's when I contacted Senator Gazelka and our representative at that time and been trying to work towards making something that is at least defendable and explainable to the citizens when they come in. You know, I don't always support a lot of legislation, but at least you can explain it. And the current penalty law is really not explainable to common sense. And I think we should, as government, be able to be somewhat reasonable. When you have tax penalties of you're a day or two late in the spring and it's a 2% penalty, and in November you're 4, 6, 8% for the same number of days late, how do you explain that to a regular citizen when they're already upset that they're having to pay a humongous penalty? And I just think in fairness and in equity, and it isn't going to affect, I don't believe, the current tax collection system. We need a penalty. I'm not saying we shouldn't have a penalty, because if you don't have any penalty, the government's become a bank for the people that want to use it. But so I support having a penalty, and a good one, if they want to let it go past January 1. But the people that just make a mistake or are a day late or a week late, the penalty law as it is right now is not explainable, and I would hope that we can correct that and get this bill passed.
And Mr. Nigren, I think I heard you say you didn't think it was going to impact the payments. You don't think there will be more late payments coming in?
Most of this affects the people that are honestly trying to pay their tax on time. There's a certain segment of society that lets it go to January and beyond, and that's where the penalty rate of 10% or whatever, I'm okay with that, because then they're using us as a bank, as a government, and we don't want that. And right now, I know in our county, because of having a penalty coming by January 1, we usually have 98.5% of the current year tax collected. So, but it's all those people in between May 15th and January 1 that are really severely punished for being good citizens, basically. So.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Nygren. Questions, members? Seeing none, Mr. Carlson, you can stay there.
Mr. Chairman, you're taking testimony on 931 as well as?
We can take testimony on both of them.
Stay for both.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I do have a handout.
Yeah, we'll get a page.
This is his handout.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson. I'm Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association that consists of 10 of the regional center counties in greater Minnesota and 4 of the ring counties here in the suburban area. My comments are really addressed to 931, which goes beyond what is in the other bill, which basically equalizes the penalties between the first and the second half payments. And other than the fact that it will cost us some money for reprogramming computers, don't have substantial concerns about it. However, on the second bill, Senate File 931, do have substantial concerns about the reductions in the penalty rates on non-homestead properties. As has already been discussed here, counties aren't in the business of being the lender of last resort. And in fact, what happens is we frequently do end up in that sort of circumstances. And what appears on its face to be high penalty rates are really a little short and frequently are less than what would be the other option for individuals seeking an unsecured loan, and that's to take a cash advance on their credit card. I've put together an example here for a property with taxes due on it of $5,000 for the year, first half $2,500, second half $2,500, and have computed the penalties on those properties. For example, on May 16th, the 4% penalty on that would be $100. For a credit card with a annual percentage rate of 24%, the comparable interest on a cash advance, assuming there's no additional charge for the cash advance, would be $50. So it is less, but as you continue to go out into the subsequent years, by September 1st, the penalty is 11%, or $275. By approximately the same period of time, September 16th, the interest is $250, so not much shy of that. And by the time you add in potential late payment penalties, for example, on my credit card, if I fail to make a payment, I would pay an additional $35. You're getting very close to comparable to what would be paid. And if you go out there in subsequent years, or subsequent periods of time, it's getting very close. Again, my credit card, I think I have relatively good interest rates. If I fail to make a payment, my interest rate goes to 29.99%. So it would be to my advantage to instead not pay my property taxes rather than taking a cash advance. Again, we're not in the business of being the lender of last resort and consequently have concerns about Senate File 931.
And just before, Mr. Carlson, I apologize. I just had your name with Mr. Nygren. I assumed you were testifying on both bills. My mistake. Do you have a position on 354? I get the opposition to 931.
Mr. Chairman, other than making the committee aware that it is going to cost us some money, in terms of reprogramming, don't have significant concerns about equalizing the rates between the first and the second half payment.
Okay, and Mr. Carlson and members, we have asked for a local impact statement on that. So we'll get an idea what that's going to cost. Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, I'm thinking we can lay over Senate File 354 and then address 931.
Yeah, I think let's just kind of do them both at the same time. They're comparable. They have the same testifiers. So I'm going to lay Senate File 354 over for possible inclusion as amended, and we will move to Senate File number 931. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, I do have the A1 amendment for the 931. It's the same amendment I had on the other bill.
Senator Gazelka has the A1 amendment. It's in your packet. This is the first stop. It's an author's amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A1's adopted. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this is a little more complex, but again, it's trying to deal with what we consider excessive penalties. And he used in his testimony, Mr. Carlson used 24% interest. You know, you can take a HELOC and get 4% interest. I mean, so, and but when we're looking at this in particular, I'm concerned about the first month. You know, I'm not really, you know, if like Mr. Nygren said, if people are abusing the system, I don't want it to be a bank. I'm just trying to address the folks that are genuinely late for a period of time where the interest rate is excessive. And so the second bill, I would prefer that Mr. Nygren talk about it. This is something that he's been working on for a while.
And Senator Gazelka, so we have the same amendment on for the two-day time period for mail-in. And Mr. Nygren will talk about the other differences between this bill and the previous bill.
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Mr. Nygren.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. Again, this bill helps equalize the penalties for the number of days late, where in the current bill it is not. The interest rates should be explainable. I think my testimony earlier pretty much covers a lot of the facts that relate to both bills, and the fact that you have people that are coming in sometimes, especially in the fall, with we have October 15th and November 15th, and we've had a number of legislative changes in the ag taxes, and with the managed forest land classification, rural vacant land, and that we're constantly seeing people that have their due dates changed from November 15th to October 15th, and they come in and all of a sudden they're late because their classification changed and then their due date changed and they didn't notice that on one parcel of many parcels. And all of a sudden, if it had been in May, it was a 2% penalty, and now it's November, they missed a payment, it's a 6% penalty. It's very difficult to explain to somebody that made an honest mistake and they're one day late that they're paying a 6% penalty. I can't support that kind of legislation as a citizen, and I speak not on behalf of a county, but as myself and the taxpayers that I represented for 30-some years in our county. It's pretty hard for them when they're good, honest, taxpaying people to have to penalize them that much, because I don't know where you would go anywhere else and be a day late and have a 6% penalty, and that's what the current law does. So hopefully we can change that.
Any questions, members? Anything else, Senator Gazelka? Anyone in the audience wish to testify for or against Senate File 354 or Senate File 931?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Rest.
Were we asking for a local impact statement on this one, too? Both of them?
Senator Rest, I believe we are, yes. We're trying to get in our head.
We really do need
what
to
the
know.
Costs are for local governments here.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Gazelka, what impact this would have on counties and school districts and in terms of resources and aid payments.
Senator Gazelka.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, I do agree. I want to, you know, look at this thing eyes wide open, but if they're collecting revenue as a result of people being a little bit late and charging too high a penalty, you know, I think we need to consider that too.
Yeah, it's Senator Rest.
Senator Gazelka, we don't often, in fact, I can't remember the last few years where we have actually, from the Tax Committee, requested a local impact statement. So we do consider this an important policy change, even though it's just a change of a couple of numbers.
And I think we're going to be surprised that this is also going to have an impact on our from earlier discussions on our school funding formula, because right. they count the fees, the penalties, as part of their. Mr. Nygren.
The penalty is split between the county and the schools, but the way the school formula works, that if the penalties goes down, the state aid, so it's a revenue-neutral item to the schools themselves. It's not to the state. When I spoke a couple weeks ago at the House on this similar bill in the House, they had an impact statement there that said insignificant cost, but you'll need to see that yourself. But I know they did mention that at the House. The Department of Revenue was there and spoke to that impact that it was they'd done that already. But it's a neutral to the schools. It will not change the school's funding. It'll change who pays it.
Change who pays. Yes, of course. Senator Dietzig.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding the local impact statement, and I know the testifiers talked about this in Minneapolis, and I see Hennepin County's here, and so it might show up on Hennepin County's too. There are a number of business owners, mostly rental property, that they use the county as the bank. They do, in their business plan, they don't pay the taxes in a timely fashion, and they go right up until they're pretty much going into forfeiture and default. And so I will ask the city in Hennepin County if they have how many people, because I think they may skew the numbers, because they're not your average person who just misses it and, you know, wakes up June 1st, oh, my gosh, I forgot to pay, and they're paying a higher penalty, because I have sympathy for them. But I think I'm going to ask Hennepin County and the city if there's any way they can kind of segment out what of those late payments are from the perennial people that they are now addressing in their rental license, because I think that may skew it.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Gudzielka, thank you for bringing this bill. There are some, I think, calendaring issues is what I'm hearing. It's really about a timeline. And I wanted to ask Mr. Nygren to expound. I thought I heard you say that sometimes these late payments are because the classification has been changed, and that has a different due date, which the property tax payer might not be aware of. And, okay, so I see you nodding that is a correct understanding. And it makes me think, though, are we addressing that issue in either of these bills, Senator Gudzielka?
Senator Gudzielka.
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, I think certainly by extending the two-day late piece, we are a little bit, and then compressing on the business side some of the rates we are. As far as the more complicated one that Mr. Carlson said he didn't know that he would be in favor of, that one would definitely do that. The penalties are lower.
Mr.
Senator Nelson.
And so, and by that, I mean the fact that the property taxpayer doesn't know that there's been a change, or it's not, I don't know where it's printed on the property tax statement. But the point is, the property taxpayer, there's been some sort of change, and they're not notified in a readily available manner to alert them to the fact that, one, your classification's been changed, and then, two, you have a different due date. And it reminds me of a case in Olmsted County where the you get your property tax statement with the assessed value, which can go up a bit, but then if there's a rate change in how the rates are adjusted so that they're accordingly, I guess the state has some type of rule that the rates have to be of a certain percent of value, and if they're not, then you have to adjust what those property tax rates are. But the issue is, again, I think the property tax holder, the property taxpayer, when they get their statement that shows the assessed value, it says what the appeal dates are. But if your assessed value doesn't go up much, you think your property taxes aren't going up much. But then there's this change in the rate, and that, by the time you see that, the appeal date has passed. And that can be quite significant. And so it seems to me that we need to look at better informing property taxpayers of these changes so that they see them before the appeal date has passed. And I'm wondering if the Mr. Nygren could speak to that a little bit about those calendar dates and when changes occur, when property taxpayers know about them, and when the appeal date is.
And Senator Nelson, the department has done pretty extensive work on a graph that lays out the timeline for this. And what you get the fall before is your valuation estimate, and then there's an appeal time on valuation, and then you get your statement the following spring, I'm assuming, and your taxes are due on the 15th of March and October.
Yes.
But Mr. Nygren.
Senator Nelson, that issue, it is very confusing for people because they, like you said, when they get their valuation notice, a lot of times they don't know what that notice means is when it comes to tax impact. And I don't know of any way that we can change how that's going to work. This is not anything related to that issue in the penalty. That has to do with the valuation, okay, which is the valuation that will be coming out this April now, end of March, first part of April, is for taxes payable next year. A lot of people never look at the valuation. They just put it away, and they don't look at the classification. It's a big problem out there, and I don't know how to correct that, but that doesn't affect the penalty so much. And I used an example of where there was, and the reason I brought that up is because of the fact that in November the penalty rate's so much higher than it is in May, and when somebody has an honest mistake that they didn't look at their tax statement and the due date and they come in a month late, they're hit with such a large penalty versus if they would have come in a month late in the spring. I was trying to explain it that way, is that if we equalize the penalty rate in the fall to the same that it is in the spring is what this one bill is trying to address, not anything to do with the changes due to classification and valuation.
Thank you. Mr. Chair. And so thank you. I realize my question is a little bit different, although it does have to do with making sure taxpayers are aware before the appeal date and the calendar date, I will follow up. My question really was not about the valuations, which I understand when those come out. It was about when a municipality changes the taxing rate for different classifications, and that appears to occur after the appeal date, which I think is significant. And I'll follow up with research staff on that. Thank you.
Very good. Very good. Anything else, Senator Gazelka? Nobody else wishing to testify in opposition? Anything else, members? Thank you. Chair, I'll lay Senate File 931 as amended over for possible inclusion. We'll get the revenue local impact statement, and then we'll have conversations.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Senator Rood. Welcome, Senator Rood. Senate File 854. You found a popular subject, Senator Rood.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Yeah, I it looks like I'm a very popular person this morning. I had no idea.
No. No amendments.
Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair and members, this is an issue that is really important, especially in greater Minnesota. I think currently about 60% of our assessors would not meet this standard. I think what we're trying to accomplish here is local control. I represent two counties that are very different. I have Aiken County, which is a large land mass, which has 16,000 people. And then I have Crow Wing County, which is a much more compact land mass, and they have 60,000 people. And so their needs in the assessing process are greatly different. And what we're trying to accomplish here is giving the counties the ability to make that decision on what level of assessors that they need and how many they need to have. And so it's a really pretty simple bill, although by the testifiers and the you wouldn't know that, but I appreciate you letting us bring this forward today, because I think one size doesn't fit all, and it really doesn't work in greater Minnesota. And so giving us some ability to make those decisions at the county level might help us out. I do believe Mr. Johnson.
Senator Rood, yeah, I think there's two county assessors that we'll ask to come up, Mr. Johnson, and I believe Mr. Stahlberger might be on the same side of this issue. Is he on my list here? Yeah. Anyway, okay, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, committee, from Nobles County's perspective, it's going to be a very challenging issue for us, and it's already showing. We have two open positions right now in our first advertisement for those positions. We had three responses. We were advertising for a CMA level.
Mr. Johnson, would you say your name for the record? It helps identify future.
Tom Johnson.
Thank you.
Continue. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee. In our posting that we had advertised for a CMA level or similar experience in appraising, we had three applications, none qualified. We had to change that to a ground level high school graduate, and we got a couple of applications we're working through right now. In a small rural counties like that, we just do not have the depth of experience.
Would you pull the mic in just a little bit? This room is, the acoustics are terrible, so if you could speak into the mic, it helps.
Okay. And yeah, that the experience level down there, we just don't have a depth of experience. The average sales of homes are in the 200 level, so there's not even appraisers. When I bought my home last year, it took almost 4 weeks for an appraiser to go through the process for the bank. So there just isn't a talent pool there to even hire from.
And Senator Rood and Mr. Johnson, this was, I'm forgetting the year that we did this, but it was a couple years ago. And it was a response to inconsistencies that we have seen in assessing that has been done across the state. And part of the conversation goes back as far as when we had the old Green Acres Law. I mean, we had 40-some counties that weren't implementing it. And you know, it was a statewide law. And so we've had concerns over consistency. And so a couple of years ago, we, you know, made this step to have more accreditation. I'm glad you're bringing the issue forward as it impacts many of the smaller rural counties, because Senator Rood, I too represent a number of those. Mm-hmm. So I share your concerns, but I also am concerned that we have uniformity across the state. And I think that we need to, you know, keep that in mind as we're having this conversation. And Senator Rood.
Mr. Chair, you know, we all want competent and qualified assessors. I think that's our goal. But I do believe as a real estate broker, we went through a period of time when the market really crashed. And so I don't think that part of the assessor, appraiser, market evaluations, I think some of the comments and the reason for the people being dissatisfied was because the market was in such a, it took a terrible crash and upward swing and downward swing in that period of time. And it was very, very difficult for the assessors and the appraisers and as a real estate broker to keep up with that market. When we did a market analysis for a property, usually we go back 6 months to find a sold property. We could not. There were not sales for comparable sales. Sometimes we had to go back as far as 18 months during that period of time. And so I think the dissatisfaction with the assessors comes from that period of time, and I don't believe it's because we didn't have competent and qualified. We just had incredible market stressors during that time. And I think in my own county, I think they've done a very good job, but I do know that we were kind of frustrated during that period of time because of the market stresses, and it was very difficult. And I think while we should recognize that fact, we still want everybody to be competent and qualified, but I think the county should have some leeway in what they need for their personnel.
I do have a little concern about giving the counties the authority to make that determination. I think we would have a hard time having consistent state policies if every county can establish that on their own. But we'll keep exploring that possibility,
well noted, Mr.
I guess.
Chair.
We're also going to have some other testifiers. But first, any questions, members? Senator Nelson?
I think my question might be for this testifier. Otherwise, I'll wait. But I just had two questions. One had to do with the cost, $240,000 annually to replace current assessors with new assessors. And so is there a higher cost to the assessors who have the AMA certification? Is that – what is that $240,000 comprised of?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, that number was derived from the fact that our local assessors are almost all semi-retired, and they don't have any desire to achieve their AMA. So we would have to hire four new assessors to cover those 19 jurisdictions, and that's the cost of getting the four new assessors all the education. And we support the education and training and the continuous learning very strongly because it's a very complex system. But that's the cost of all the classes for four assessors to, and basically because of our experience, it's starting basically at the ground level.
And Mr. Johnson, to further answer Senator Nelson's question, a significant amount of those costs are lodging and travel because you travel to the meetings.
Correct.
And I don't know what the percentage is, but it's probably 40% or something like that.
At least.
At least.
Yeah.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, Mr. Chair, well, that kind of leads me to my next question, which is what type of training are we talking about for the accredited Minnesota assessor? You know, how long of training is it, and can it be done online, especially now that some of those costs have to do with lodging and travel? So what's the length of training that we're talking about, and then is it available online?
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair and Senator Nelson, to my knowledge, they're not available online at this point. Most of the trainings that I'm aware of are one-week trainings. There are some shorter trainings. It's a real mix. It all goes by the Board of Assessors' plan to achieve each of the certifications.
And Senator Nelson, I think what I heard Mr. Johnson say earlier is they originally, you know, tried to hire somebody that was partway through the accreditation process. It's a series of steps. There wasn't any application, so they ended up starting at ground zero, and hence that's also part of the cost driver is because there's multiple levels.
Thank you.
Senator, anything else, Senator Nelson?
No, thank
okay.
you.
Okay. Anything else, members? Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Mr. May, and is Mr. Stahlberger here? Oh, he is. Okay.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom May. I'm the retired Hennepin County Assessor. I'm here representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. The MAO is split on the issue of accreditation at this point concerning the 2013 legislation. And the reason we're split is we have a lot of different opinions across the state, as you might imagine. Even though we're split on that issue, the mission statement for MAO is very clear. It's on the bottom of our position statement that we hand out each year that I think you have a copy of from previous meetings. The mission of Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers is to provide education and information to promote excellence in property appraisal and assessment administration through professional development with the highest ethical standards. With that said, the State Board of Assessors is the body that coordinates education, designation, and licensure for our association. They're a legislatively appointed board, and we have included a handout today that shows from the State Board the requirements for the four designations that we have right now. It's about a seven-page document that you have, and it goes through the requirements to be a certified Minnesota assessor, certified Minnesota assessment specialist, accredited Minnesota assessor, and a senior accredited Minnesota assessor. And with the those designations, of course, the number of years of experience increase as you go up the line. I won't go through those at this point, but you can certainly take a look at that and see what the different requirements are. The State Board of Assessors, of course, you can access their website on the Department of Revenue's website by putting in Minnesota State Board of Assessors, and you'll see all this online, as well as their projections for required designations currently and in 2019. Those are all online. At this point in the State Board's newsletter from 2015, we have a certified Minnesota assessors. There's 208 in the state. Certified Minnesota assessors with income qualifications, there's 265. Certified Minnesota assessment specialists, there's 8. Certified Minnesota assessment specialists with income qualifications, there's 51. Accredited Minnesota assessors, 66. And senior accredited Minnesota assessors, 251. So that's our current numbers at this point.
Mr. May, on those numbers, do you have an idea how many are retiring off one side and how many new ones are coming in on the other side? What's going on? Do you have any feel for what's going on there?
I think we have some assessors that are going to testify that they may be able to answer that better than I can.
Okay.
But we're like any other profession. We have a lot of people at the top end that will be retiring in the next several years.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you. Mr. May.
With me today to testify on behalf of MAO, to present the side of the MAO that supported the original legislation is Stephen Baker, the Ramsey County Assessor. To present the side of the concerns that MAO has with the AMA legislation is Tom Dibbing, the Houston County Assessor, and they can give you an idea of both sides of the issue so that you can see why we're split. And also here today is Michael Stahlberger, the Blue Earth County Assessor, who's the chair of our Education Steering Committee, who can talk a little bit about MAO education. So with that, I'll turn it over to Stephen Baker.
Mr. Baker.
And Mr. Chair, Senator, just before you leave the table, when you gave those numbers on there, what is the percentage of the need that's out there? I mean, that mean maybe the assessors that you have now, but what's the number that you need to fill the positions in the state? Do you have any idea? I mean,
so Mr. May, if this becomes fully implemented in 2017 or 2019, I don't recall the date. What would be the expected numbers that we would need to fill the positions? Do you know that?
Well, certainly, I think there's 859 total, or 849 total designated assessors in the state, and I would think that number wouldn't change as some retire, they're replaced. But what you would see is you would see the entirety being either accredited Minnesota assessor or senior accredited or working towards that. So there'd be the certified Minnesota assessors working towards AMA. Right now, I believe it's 1 year to be certified, so there'll still be that group of people that are working on the certification. There'd still be the group of people working on the accredited. So there would be still the array, but I assume it would still be in that range of 849.
So the total would be the same. The pipeline might be a little more full.
I would suspect so, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Stephen Baker. I'm the Ramsey County Assessor. I'm past president of MAO. I've been a longtime member of the Legislative Committee and a past chair of that committee. As Mr. May testified, I was the immediate past president at the time that this legislation was originally proposed and approved in 2013. And was involved in a number of conversations around it. And as Tom suggested, our members have concerns, and they had some concerns then. But you know, I think what's paramount in our minds is that we have a Minnesota property tax system that is high quality, that is fair, and that our citizens support. The property tax is really, in large part, a voluntary tax. I mean, I know that there's a lot of pressure on it, but people have to step up and write a check generally each year to pay the tax. And so we rely on them doing that. they need to support the system. They don't, we don't want them to be cynical about it. We want them to believe that they're going to be treated fairly. I've seen in my 25 years in the business a lot of changes towards really a higher level of customer service, if you will, for the citizens of the state. And what we came to 3 years ago or 2 years ago was that this was just another evolution on that path of continuing to provide high-level service for the citizens of Minnesota. There was folks involved in the discussion then that were assessors prior to my time that were in the business when licensing was first passed in Minnesota. And as they discussed that, the similarities were pretty clear that at that time there was controversy. There was people that felt that the timing wasn't good. They were near the end of their careers, and why should I get a license, and I don't need this, and there was concerns about cost and recruitment, but we worked through it. And I don't think anybody today would say, let's go back to where we don't have licensing. And so now we're just at another step where do we want to require our Minnesota assessors to have a higher level of license, perhaps? You know, I go back. I got my AMA in my sixth year in the business, which is what the current law now would require, basically. If you get in the business today, you got 2 years to get a certified Minnesota assessor license, and then you'd have another 4 years to get your AMA. So I would have met the current law, but probably not, you know, I hate to admit it, not really on my own, because the reason I got it done when I did was because I was required to, because a job came up that offered me an opportunity, and I needed the AMA to take that position. So I think part of this is us just trying to provide that push for our Minnesota assessors that they need to continually strive to improve and get that higher level of license. I have a number of staff in my office that have been in the business a long time that are still certified. They're high-quality appraisers. We have a path to a promotion where they would get an automatic pay raise if they got their accreditation. They still have not done it. So this law would really force them to do it over time. I think that's probably a positive change for Minnesota. The other concerns I would have about the legislation we're talking today is it creates potentially kind of a patchwork, and I'm not sure that it really does what it is proposed to do, because as Tom suggested, the Minnesota Board of Assessors has a schedule of what licenses are required to hold, like to be a township assessor, a city assessor, or a county assessor. And that schedule currently as adopted would require all the township assessors to be accredited, the city assessors to be accredited, and of course state law requires the county assessors to be senior accredited. It would require all that still by 2019. So if this law passes, then instead of having the statute govern, I believe it would then say that the Board of Assessors schedule, which is adopted under rule, which was enabled under statute, would be the one that would govern. So I fear that there would be some misconceptions that some of these requirements are going away when, in fact, they may not. The Board of Assessors could still act to retract some of those requirements that are currently in the rule. But whether or not they do that or not, I think, is questionable. And then as for local control, my board, my county board, we have five positions in my office that really do the core of the appraising in my office. Three of those positions already require accreditation. Two of those positions don't. So by resolution, my board can set an accreditation requirement as a minimum qualification in a position. So I would just caution that if we are going to change the current accreditation requirement, let's try to do so in a way that doesn't create a patchwork around Minnesota, that has good clarity and is going to encourage consistency around the state and really is going to accomplish what all our goals are, which is a high-quality system.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Senator Gonzalez.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I'm just wondering if some of the problems are with, you know, we heard the first testifier talk about they're going to lose some folks that have a lot of experience but don't want to take that test or move up to that level. What if we grandfathered in some of those folks that are already there? I mean, is that part of that potentially could solve some of this? Because I think you make a reasonable point that as if people are coming in and they know the expectations, then they're working towards it. But if you have people that have been there for 20 years or longer, they know a lot already. The extra licensure, I'm not sure that that's going to do a whole lot. So is that something that you would be open to?
Let me add a little bit to your question, if you don't mind. You're headed to where I was been kind of contemplating, and also maybe contemplate a waiver at the commissioner level and what your thoughts are with regard to that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelko, could you explain a little bit more what you mean by a waiver?
So all of the county assessors have to have the highest level of accreditation. They have a individual that's been in this, the next step down, and I don't have the terminology right, that been performing the job well, normally after his four-year time period would have been required to move up one level, but is within a few years of retirement. Maybe the county assessor could apply to the commissioner of revenue, who has, I think, authority over the board, for a waiver of the additional licensure requirement. And the reason I'm thinking about this at all is as a mechanism to get us to where the pipeline is filled up enough to where we wouldn't have staffing issues down the road. It's a delaying mechanism is what I'm contemplating. And I hope I'm not taking your question away, but
great minds think alike.
Yeah, so Mr. Baker.
I share concerns about future staffing. I mean, I know there's a sense that in the metro area we have kind of, a huge pool of potential staff. My office has trouble filling our commercial appraisal positions now. We've hired a number of residential appraisers in without any previous assessing experience, so they're not licensed as assessors. Some have had appraisal experience, some have not. And we get them licensed, through the first few years. I think that, grandfathering in some positions, perhaps that makes sense. I'm not sure that the other bill that I saw this year that grandfathered in everybody after like a year ago or something, like January of 15, really accomplishes the goals that were initially set out when this legislation was adopted. Senator Gazelka, you mentioned something like 20 years experience. To me, that makes more sense than 1 year. You have more people that are being pushed to get their high level of licensure, and you have less of a dual standard where you're not really starting over just from a year ago, where you've got all these people grandfathered in, and then you've got a whole new crop that have a whole different set of rules. As for the waiver, I think that, Mr. Chair, I think that makes excellent sense if we can come up with a way to make that work. The Board of Assessors has already been working on some transitional licenses to accommodate some of the shortfall of appraisers coming into the business for jurisdictions that have trouble. So this would be kind of an extension, another tool that would meet that. So we have some transitional licenses now being created, and then if we had a waiver to keep some people in the business, perhaps that's a good combination to be able to make sure we have enough staff to do the job over time.
Thank you.
I think the lion's share of people in the business really want to do a great job. And part of this is about giving them the training and the tools to be able to do that. I had an interesting conversation with one of my appraisers recently who came to my office with a lot of experience as a fee appraiser, but not as an assessor. And he's a lead now in our residential unit. And when he started out and had to get his accreditation, because it's required for the position that he holds in my office, he thought it was kind of busy work, he told me, and didn't really support it. But he said he was really surprised at how much he learned going through the process, and he very much supports it now. And I think that's going to be the experience of a lot of Minnesota assessors that go through this. They may go into it thinking that it's busy work or it's not something they really need, but I think we're determined to make it an experience that is going to add value and allow them to be a better quality assessor for the Minnesota citizens.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. We're going to start. Senator Rood.
And Mr. Chair, I think that's a very valid point. In the real estate industry, we do have a pathway for individuals to become brokers who have extensive background in the financial institutions and And so they don't have to go through the full process because they already have the life experiences and the business experiences to do that. And so I think that that is a very valid pathway to explore.
Okay. Senator Nelson.
Well, just a brief follow-up to the good discussion here. I am very sympathetic to the need here, especially in smaller communities. While half my district is one of our largest cities, the other half is comprised of 14 townships and some of our state's smallest cities. So I understand the need there. But and so I was intrigued by the grandfathering conversation, which I think could be very helpful. But the thing that I'm wondering about is, you're correct, there is no online coursework for this, at least according to the state's website here. And I find that very unusual because so many of our licensures, degrees, in fact, have online training. And so I'm just wondering if the online market has not caught up yet with the new law from 2013. But I would like to encourage the assessor's organization to really look at using technology that's so readily available today, which would be the online coursework, which we've done successfully in many other areas. And then the last piece that I would just mention is I did notice, and thank you to staff for bringing me the levels of licensure, the CMA actually, one of the things that could be problematic is it does require, in addition to that coursework, which could be online, 1 year's apprenticeship under a licensed assessor. So that could be an issue, although fortunately the next sentence says, in lieu of this requirement, the board may consider alternate experience. So I guess I'm intrigued by the grandfathering aspect, but also really going forward looking at getting that training online so people can take it in the place where they would wish, at the time that they wish, and at their own pace. They could rewind, you know, they could go back and see what they need to see, and it'd be a cost savings as well.
Thank you. And I think we need to continue on through the testifiers. We have a number of people yet to go, so let's Mr. Diving?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, my name's Tom Diving. I'm the Houston County Assessor. I'm also a member of the Legislative Committee and the Ag Chair for MAAL. The concerns that are out there are usually in the rural communities, the rural counties, and I think Mr. Johnson explained that well, where they have local appraisers and probably will not get their AMAs, and thus the county will have to replace them at the county level and stuff. And I'll give you a little example of my county. I have three appraisers. They're CMA income qualified. They all do a really, really good job. I'm 66. I'll be retiring at some point here in the future, not near future, but some point here within the next few years, I guess. And I've recommended to the three to get their accreditation, to be able to step into my shoes, so to speak, and to get their AMA. And two of them are going to do it. But I have one appraiser that's planning on retiring maybe shortly after I retire. And he was planning on retiring in 2020, 2021, somewhere in there. And if the current law stays in place, he would not be able to continue because he wouldn't have his AMA designation at that point. So I kind of welcome a little bit the idea. The waiver would be a really good option for that appraiser. He has 20 years of experience, excellent. We're a small county, do not have a lot of highly involved appraisals, so yeah, the CMA income qualified have worked real well for us out in Houston County.
Thank you. Mr. Stahlberger?
Yes. Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, Senators. My name is Michael Stahlberger, and I'm the County Assessor and Deputy Director of Taxpayer Services in Blue Earth County. I'm here today representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers as chair of our Member Development and Standards Steering Committee. Our steering committee oversees six work groups that are focused on different areas of assessor education, development, and standards. This structure was put in place in 2013, partially in response to the legislative changes with the accreditation, but also just in response to the need for more education and development of assessors statewide. It's also evidence of our dedication as an association to education and our partnership with the Department of Revenue on educating our assessors throughout the state. As you can tell, our association is split on this accreditation issue that's before us today. However, one thing that we are not split on is our commitment to education. Our development and standard structure allows us to dedicate more resources to this educational piece, including curriculum development and professional development standards for our assessors. We have increased our numbering of courses that are required as part of the core for all of those licensure levels that you have in front of you. We are now offering most of those courses twice a year, and we're also developing new courses. We are also looking to online education, as has been brought up today. The Department of Revenue has started that with some education for our local boards of appeal and equalization, and we're looking at possibly continuing that partnership with some of our other courses as possible. Related to professional development, we have started forming regional groups to help assessors achieve that higher level of licensure designation, and we are also creating numerous resources on our website and building a directory of subject matter experts throughout the state. Our association is dedicated to providing the resources necessary for member development and standards, and we're trying to respond to the demand that's being placed on our association in light of the accreditation requirement, as well as the changing demographics that have been brought up here as well with the retirement wave that is likely coming our way. We would really appreciate some finality in this matter so that we can continue our planning down the road to respond to the needs that we have as they arise, but we are also willing to entertain any possibilities for grandfathering or other provisions that might be available for some assessors.
Thank you, Mr. Stollenberg. Questions, members? And gentlemen and Senator Rood, we're going to hear from some testifiers here about some of the issues. And I know in Houston County it might not be an issue, but across the state, there are examples of problems with some of the assessing practices, and our concern, or my concern, and I think the committee's concern, is that we have uniformity in assessing no matter where you are. You have an equal expectation that the assessing is going to be done on your property the same no matter where you live and no matter who's doing the assessing. And so that's the goal. If we have to spend a little time to get to the end goal, you know, we'll contemplate that. And Senator Rood, I really want to thank you for bringing this bill forward, because it gives us the opportunity to have this conversation that we're having today and to see if there is some place to move forward with this. So let's move to the next testifiers. Thank you, gentlemen. And Ms. Geis and Mr. Cummings, I think, would be next. Ms. Geis, good to see you again. Welcome to the committee.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cindy Geis, and I'm from Scott County. I am the Property and Customer Services Director. I'm also the appointed County Auditor Treasurer, so don't hold that against me. And why would I be weighing in on this issue is probably your number one question. What was my involvement, and what do I have to offer to you that you haven't already heard here today? Well, back in 2008, our county assessor retired. And in lieu of having a county assessor and someone qualified to step in, I was appointed as acting county assessor. I don't know if that was good or bad, but it definitely opened my eyes to some of the challenges out there for our county assessors. The county assessor currently reports up through my division, so we do have a lot of interaction, and he's also in charge of the property tax department, so he has a lot of interaction with the auditor treasurer side as well. So we're a very collaborative group of people down in Scott County. But back in 2009, we had an issue with one of our appraisers, and this was the headline in our local paper: township appraiser accused of negligence. And it was mortifying that we had to get to this level to try to fix an issue that possibly was hanging out there for a number of years. I can't really comment on prior to my involvement in 2009 on what occurred, because it would all be speculation. But we had an appraiser. It is a local appraiser, and there's a ton of local appraisers out there that really are great people. They know their job. They know it well. But on the flip side, not only local appraisers, but county appraisers as well. We have some that do as little. They skirt under the curtain, and with that, there are some issues with consistency, accuracy, efficiencies, and in the end result, who pays? It was our taxpayers. We had an issue with this local assessor, and one of our problems is that we were hogtied because we didn't hire them. We had to fix the issue, but the statute also says once you fix the issue, then you're going to reinstate that local assessor and let them do it all over again. And so now those taxpayers get to pay twice. They get to pay their township, the township cost, and then they get to pay the county's charges to the township again to fix all the issues. With this local assessor, been in the business for a long time. And so, you know, you think they've been in the business, they're highly qualified. The township officials, he was an appraiser for three different townships. They like him. What we didn't know is that he wasn't doing his job. He wasn't going to the properties. He wasn't seeking additional education at all. In fact, he was actually on the flip side. Status quo, don't tell me to do anything more than I have to. I don't know the current rules. I'm not on top of the current practices. I'm not looking for efficiencies, and I don't even know the current statutes. When the Green Acres provision came through, no clue. We didn't find that out until a couple years later. So not only did we have, now the three townships that he assessed in were 1 per 40s. They were all ag. We had a mess. We had sheds on property that didn't have sheds. We had houses that were supposed to be ramblers that were two stories. We had issues across the board. So we had to go through, and what our challenge was is we hired three what we called just data collectors. Their job was to go out there, take pictures, and take that tape measure and measure. Now, these townships, some of these people hanging out there, our residents are like, who are you and what are you doing on my land? Get off. Some of them had never really seen an appraiser out there before. That, to me, was alarming. What do you mean you haven't seen an appraiser? He's supposed to be there once every 4 years. Now it's once every five. No, we have never had anybody come to our house. So not only that was alarming to me, so I'm going, oh, great. Now we have to assess every single property in every single township. We have to take pictures of everything, and we have to bring that forward. And in the meantime, what do we do with this gentleman here that we can't fire from the job? We didn't hire that person, so we were very hogtied. With my job, we informed the Department of Revenue. We worked closely with them on what to do with some of the negligence that had occurred in the assessment practices. We also worked with our townships on how do we fix this, and kind of laying the carpet down, saying we will be there and we will take care of this issue. But if you bring this person back, it is going to come at additional charge to them. You're going to pay twice. You're going to pay him, and you're going to pay us, because now the writing is on the wall that he's not doing his job. So we're going to have to do it for him. And is it strictly this local? No. The other thing that I had become aware of back in the day when I took over was that we had people who were very comfortable in their jobs with the county as well, had been there for a long time. Also never sought that continuing education. Do you want to be better? Do you want to be more knowledge? Knowledge is power. You can empower people to do things better. And without that empowerment, you become stagnant and you become a little bit lazy. So my experience was one where we had a lot of issues. We had to fix them. It was very costly. It was very costly to those residents living in that in those townships. And from me, my perspective is that Senate File 840, 854 doesn't entirely address just that laziness and that an accountability issue. However, I do think that requiring additional accreditations will keep those people who want to move forward with the industry. They want to be better. They want to do things more efficiently. And knowledge is power. And the ability to communicate with those taxpayers will not only educate them on maybe some issues they wouldn't have known before or some topics they wouldn't have known before without that AMA achievement or accreditation, but it also, I think, makes those appraisers just better in how they do their job. So I would encourage you, based upon what we had endured at Scott County, to consider keeping the accreditations in there, but also looking for some of the accountability issues when like issues occur at the local level, and how do we mitigate those, and possibly, if nothing else, removing the requirement to reinstate someone who's been called out as being negligent.
Thank you, Ms. Geis. I think we'll turn to the department for now. Mr. Cummings?
Greetings, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity for the department to be a resource on this bill. This is an important hearing, as accreditation of assessors is key to ensuring that all Minnesotans, no matter where they live, have the assessment laws applied fairly, appropriately, and equitably. Yet, Mr. Chair, to be honest, I'm apprehensive that, you know, this bill hearing may send a message that these reforms will be removed. To go further into the topic of assessor accreditation and what we've done at the department, I'm pleased to introduce two of my colleagues at the Department of Revenue that have expertise in both administration and assessment. Cindy Raleigh is our division director for the Property Tax Division. In that role, she oversees the property tax or in the implementation in partnership with local units of government of the property tax laws. John Clocksiem is our assistant director for the Property Tax Division, where he oversees assessment issues. He's also a former assessor. Before I turn it over to Director Raleigh, Commissioner Bowerly was planning on being here this morning to be in this chair, but she was unable to make it. But she wanted to thank you personally for your leadership on assessor accreditation.
Thank you, Mr. Cummings. And my intention, and we'll see where the committee goes with this, but from my perspective, I don't have any intention of undoing the accreditation. I'm trying to figure out a way to make it work. And so that's where we're at. But undoing it is not in my plans. So I'd like to hear from the specialists at the department. Now, Ms. Raleigh and Mr. Clocksiem, and you can stay there, Ms. Geis, if you want. I think there's room. I'd like to give the committee a chance to ask questions. Is there a third chair over there, Mr. Clocksiem? Ms. Raleigh first. Welcome, Ms. Raleigh.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Cindy Raleigh. I'm the Director of Property Tax at the Minnesota Department of Revenue, and I'm pleased to offer some information for you this morning.
Ms. Raleigh, if you could move a little closer to the mic. The acoustics in this room are not good.
The current law requires every individual who appraises or physically inspects property to determine valuation, they must obtain licensure as an accredited Minnesota assessor by July 1st, 2019. As Mr. May mentioned, the current license levels in general order are CMA, or Certified Minnesota Assessor, the first level, AMA, and then SAMA, or Senior Accredited. Senate File 854 modifies the rules for assessor accreditation and assistance to county assessors. The proposal repeals the current accreditation requirements and instead requires assessors to be licensed at a level appropriate to the property they assess. The intent of the original law was to ensure fair, equitable, and consistent assessment across the state of Minnesota, to develop a pool of qualified assessors to take over the duties of county assessors in the cases of retirements or attrition, to address constituent concerns about assessor practices, we've heard a few examples, to address inconsistent assessment practices, to create a level of public trust in the fairness and equity of assessment, to compromise with individuals who wanted to have local assessing offices abolished and require all counties to use a true county assessment system. And that's where there are no local assessors and only county assessor employees. To reflect the professional nature of assessment work, it's very similar to the professional work of CPAs, attorneys, electricians, and others, and to support and encourage assessors to seek the highest level licenses and continually improve their knowledge through additional education and experience. In short, licensure provides accountability, credibility, improved quality, uniformity, and professional growth. Other professions also have license requirements, CPAs, electricians, and attorneys, to name a few. And experience in those areas suggests that these requirements help build a common base of shared understanding and expertise among those in the profession. Since 2013, since the law was passed in 2013, the Department of Revenue has made a number of changes to meet the demands from individuals looking to achieve AMA licensure. We already offered courses, and many of those courses were available in classroom format or online already. And we doubled our number of week-long course offerings for AMA licensure. And we worked with MAAO to create additional courses that address assessment concerns. And some of the specially created classes relate to the assessment of agriculture properties, apartment properties, and agricultural homesteads. A key part of the AMA accreditation process is to write a form appraisal report and have it graded by the State Board of Assessors. And to handle the anticipated increased demand, the State Board of Assessors recruited and selected more report graders as well. To date, some assessors have taken steps towards the AMA licensure. However, there are more to come. Our most recent data shows that more than 60% of assessors were at the CMA or CMAS level, and most of these assessors would need to achieve AMA accreditation by July 1st of 2019.
And Ms. Rowley, did I hear you say that this is offered online, or there are parts of it that are offered online?
We do have online course offerings, yes.
And Ms. Rowley, we're hearing about the costs of going from a high school level degree to this fully accreditation. What are your thoughts with regard to those estimates of cost? Do you have a feel for what the department would think about how much money and how long it might take to get from the entry level to the highest accreditation?
Mr. Chair, I believe that the costs and expenses vary greatly depending on where you're coming from and how much travel is included. The courses that we offer are offered at our cost only. They were not intended to make a profit. We're simply trying to pass along information that the assessors can use.
And what one other? I assume these are done in St. Paul.
Mr. Chair.
Ms. Rowley.
They actually are offered throughout the state. We will offer courses in different locations to make it more convenient.
Oh, very good. Thank you. Let's get the last testifier, and then we'll go to questions.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Senja.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And was it Ms. Rowley?
Ms. Rowley.
Ms. Rowley, I'm probably display my ignorance to this whole profession in terms of what they do and so on and so forth. But if, for instance, I were to engage in your pathway towards accreditation, and if I got there, would I be in a position to, for instance, go to the Crown Plaza in downtown St. Paul and be fully able to assess that building in terms of value, and at the same time go to, say, an implement dealer in Rushford and appraise that value? I mean, It seems to me that life experience matters quite a bit when you do this, and you can't take, for instance, those extremes and necessarily learn them off a PowerPoint or a book or something like that. That you have to be there. You got to taste the community. You got to know the landscape financially and from a real estate perspective. There must be some great value, I would think, at least to that life experience in terms of doing the job and again, knowing the community landscape in terms of what the values are. But how much does the program really teach people? I'm sure there's consistencies across the board, no matter whether it's Rushford or St. Paul, but there's also local flavor that I think is interjected into this process, I would believe.
Sure. I'd like to refer that question to Mr. Kloxing.
Mr. Kloxing.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sunjum.
Identify yourself for the record, please.
My name is John Kloxing. I'm with the Revenue Property Tax Division.
Thank you.
The four levels of licensure allow appraisers to assess property. There is a restriction for income-producing property where they have to have that certification. The certification is inherent within the AMA and SMA license level. For those that are certified Minnesota assessors and certified Minnesota assessor specialists, there is an income certification in order to appraise income-producing properties. Otherwise, assessors that are licensed can value any other type of property.
Mr. Chair, and that would be almost irrespective of the complexity of the building.
Mr. Klockheim.
That is correct. Okay. Appraisers will rely on the training that they have received and their knowledge, like you said, sure, of the local area to assist them in their appraisals, and also staff within the division and the Department of Revenue provides guidance. We do have a property tax compliance officer who specializes in complex properties to assist assessors.
Thank you.
Okay. Your testimony, Mr. Klockheim.
Mr. Chair, over the past years, the property tax system has become more layered and not less so. You are familiar with our expanding number of property tax classifications. I believe there's 52, more than any other state. And our multi-step agricultural homestead process, and you're familiar with the flow chart that was brought up before the committee earlier, and the various tax programs that have made administration more complex. Having well-trained and educated assessors with greater knowledge, common education, and greater experience helps to achieve consistency for property owners. Property owners have access to more information than ever. This means that trust in the system can be shaken when assessment practices vary. Property tax information is transparent, and because property owners can look at comparable properties online, uniform treatment and assessment practices across assessors are essential to public trust. One of the benefits we see of the current law is to promote consistency across assessors. Inconsistent assessment issues have required the legislature to review some assessment practices, including fermentation tanks and agricultural chemical containment facilities. Requiring education, like other professionals, helps create an environment of consistent and equitable assessment practices statewide. Finally, both the legislature and taxpayers have expressed concerns about agricultural values and the validity of agricultural assessments. Providing more consistent education on agricultural values puts assessors in a better position to uniformly value agricultural property. More education enables assessors to identify what should be included in agricultural value and how to make agricultural valuation work well statewide. I believe one of the purposes of the licensure law was to ensure that properties would still be assessed properly and timely when qualified licensed assessor leaves or retires. Under this bill, there would be knowledge gaps in offices if only one person had the appropriate license level for certain properties and that person left. We've talked, previous testifiers have talked about the age level of assessors. I do believe that there is a bulge in the plus 50 range, and having accredited assessors being able to fill that gap would be beneficial. Clearly, when there is potential for retirements, taxpayers would still expect the same level of assessment quality. Having higher qualified assessors in place, or in case of retirement or attrition, is a good for taxpayers in Minnesota.
Thank you. Questions, members? Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, my question is for Ms. Geis. Do you think there is good justification to maybe distinguish the accreditation requirements for these local appraisers versus the county appraisers? And the reason I say that is you have to be appraising at Scott County thousands of properties, where a local appraisal
maybe having several hundred or a thousand that they might be responsible for. And I'm thinking to my own experience in accounting, where you have certain junior level accountants that are then supervised by senior level accountants with the CPA requirement and all that it takes to supervise the folks underneath them. I'm wondering if a structure like that for appraisers makes sense, so that at the county level or any governmental entity that's responsible for appraisal has the very highest requirements, but then also is allowed to have some kind of trainee program or development program to develop those accreditations. And then when the government is going to contract, whether it's a township contracting or a county contracting or a city for local appraisals, then we go back to that requirement of the very highest levels and supervision, so that if they are responsible, they're signing off on these transactions, these appraisals, and then moving them forward. I wonder if there's some way to distinguish it that way, instead of saying we're going to grandfather in folks that don't have the credentials, make sure that we have the supervision and the accountability at those highest levels for everybody performing these services.
Ms. Geis.
Mr. Chair, Senator Ortman, you are correct in that some of those smaller townships where, if it is all agricultural, maybe the requirements are a little bit different. However, like in Scott County, we currently do 100% assessing now. Those three local townships that had issues decided they don't ever want to face that issue again, so they actually contracted with us. Additionally, since that time frame, we've probably replaced 80% of our assessors because, again, they were underperforming. They weren't meeting my standards. Our assessors today that we currently have, our appraisers in our office, they yearn for that knowledge, and they want to not only do the agricultural type of properties, but they also want to be exposed to the commercial industrial side of it. So we combine some of our townships with the local cities in that same neighborhood, so they get a lot of different experience. They grow with that. They know when to challenge different things, and they also know different questions to ask. They have brought a lot to our team. Now, from the side of, well, what if you don't need that level of experience in those smaller townships? We have hired assessment technicians, and they are more on the data collecting side. They are not accredited in any area, but they are a stepping stone to get into that industry. So they're not licensed as an assessor. Their job is just to go out there. They're going to gather data for us. They're going to bring back different things. And then they're going to hand that off to somebody who does have the accreditations that can take that information and move it forward. So we do have a little bit of a training pool. And we also get to know the people a little bit before we hire them on as an accredited assessor. We want to make sure that they are a driven person who wants to stay within the industry, and that they know that consistency, accuracy, and accountability are first and foremost for not only us as stewards of the county and stewards for our township and the dollars that we spend, but for the taxpayers themselves. Ultimately, they want people to get it right, and that's what our first and foremost goal is. In addition, Mr. Chair,
Ms. Geis.
This is a costing of what it would cost to get that licensure from all different levels. And this is Scott County's cost estimates given our location and proximity to the metro area, but it may give you a little bit of understanding of what those costs may be. And I will,
if you could get that to us, we'd appreciate it.
I will leave this with you. I apologize for not bringing copies. I was going to use it as a talking point, and I'm too shy to talk, so, you know.
We can tell.
Clearly.
Anything else, members? Ms. Rowley, we had some conversations about some of the information that came into the department last year as the egg homestead checks were being issued. And are you able to talk a little bit about that today, or is that something for another day? Because I understand there were errors as you were reviewing parcels and owners, and is that something that we could discussed briefly here this morning?
Mr. Chair,
Ms. Rowley.
I'm afraid I did not bring that information with me today, but I'd be happy to provide it.
Okay. And members, I'm referring to the information that was required in order for people to receive a homestead check last fall issued by the department. There were a number of checks issued to people who had passed on. There were a number of ag classifications that weren't ag. And it further is reasoning to make sure that our assessing is done properly. And, you know, back in the day when I was a local elected official, school board and county board, and we were doing our truth and taxation meetings, I mean, these valuations, those are the questions that come to those meetings. And we really need to make sure that the people doing that work are getting it right. And so, anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 854? Senator Rood, any closing comments?
Mr. Chair and members, I just really appreciate allowing us to bring this forward. It's a very, as you can see with the testifiers, a very complex issue. It affects Metro and Greater Minnesota differently, and I have all. I know that this tax committee will do a great job in trying to come to a solution and a resolution that works for everyone. We all want good accreditation and quality, and so that's our goal. And so, if we can possibly help in the implementation of this to get to that goal, I know that you'll be successful in doing that. And I would be happy to work on this bill and change it in any way that gets us to that goal. So thank you, Mr. Chair and members.
And thank you, Senator Rood. And this is, I think, as everyone can tell, is kind of part of an ongoing dialogue here. So we'll keep working on it, and we'll go from there. Seeing nothing else, was this amended? Chair will lay 854 over for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Rood. Yep, I have to find my stuff.
The next bill on the agenda for today is Senate File Number 8 from Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. And Madam Chair, Senate File 8 is a bill that would continue to move us forward on paying back the shifts that have occurred in the last number of years as Minnesota, previous years, has gone through budget challenges. This is the last of the June accelerated shift repayment. We did make some progress on this last year, increasing the threshold from $125,000 to $250,000. The percent that is accelerated is now at 81%, which is down some. This cost of this bill is in the neighborhood of $200 million, so we don't know if we'll be able to accomplish all of it, but as I look at the Senate and where we've been in the past, we traditionally have tried to pay these shifts off and try to be as fiscally responsible as we can in that matter in order to make sure that these things are available for future legislators to utilize if they would need to. And so I'm here with Senate File 8. I would ask for your support in our effort to repay this shift. They've just been handed the revenue note, and all funds impact is $286 million in 16. It's one-time money, and then an ongoing cost of around $9 million. And so, Madam Chair, with that, I'll stand for questions.
Senator Skoy, when I was looking at the bill this morning, I'm sure there's an answer that a simple one, and I don't, and I probably should know it. But anyway, people who collect the tax and send it in also collect the local sales taxes. And I just want to make sure that I understand that this includes, they're not, that this includes all sales taxes that are due. So whether they're sent to the state or sent to the state and then passed on to the local governments, could you refresh my understanding of what happens when a vendor collects the tax and sends it in? He sends it in, or she, or whatever. They send it in to the state rather than to any local government. Is that, and then the state disperses it to the local governments that have imposed a, that's my first question, that I'm imposed a sales tax. Is that?
Senator Rest, I believe.
Do I understand that right? Or
yep, I understand it, and I believe that's correct, but I'm going to turn to Ms. McQuay.
Madam Chair and members, whatever the collector collects, they will remit to the state. What's shown on the revenue estimate is the impact to the general fund. So the part that is remitted to the local jurisdiction will follow suit with the collection of whatever is in current law, but it won't show the impact to the general fund. Does that answer
Ms.
your question?
Ms. McQuay.
Yeah, so what impact, I mean, does it have any impact on like the sales tax collected in the metropolitan area for transit, that sales tax, does that delay, is that big enough to have any impact on their cash flow under current law, would you think, or not?
Madam Chair and members, I can certainly follow up with the department on this.
And I'm not looking for like a local impact statement. I'm just kind of, you know, what's the magnitude in general for if we undid the accelerated payment, which I support, I mean, I'm on the bill, but will that have any cash flow impact?
Well,
what do
Senator,
you think?
Senator Rest, my thought on it is if that 6.5% is $224 million, and this quarter cent for transit in the metropolitan area would be a percentage, you know, whatever that percentage is of the total, that would be the impact. I think I'm thinking about that properly. So it would be a relatively small number, but it would be a number.
Yeah, I just sometimes cash flow issues come down to $5 or $6 million in order to keep things moving along. So I'm just curious about that.
And Madam Chair,
Ms. McQuay.
Once it is collected by the Department of Revenue, it is then remitted to the local jurisdiction. So I think it would also depend on the timing at which the local jurisdictions are paid, and this may not. I mean, the general fund can absorb a lot of the payments to the local jurisdictions, and it may not at all be affected by.
Because they might be, Ms. McQuay, they might be on remitting to the local governments might be on a different schedule anyway, and so getting rid of the accelerated, if I'm understanding it, what you're saying, getting rid of the accelerated might not affect that payment schedule at all, or really minimally. Is that?
Madam Chair, I would think that might be the case.
And Madam Chair, if I could draw your attention to the dollar amount for the Natural Resources and Arts Funds, that's $13 million. That's 3/8 of a cent statewide. So a quarter of a cent in the metropolitan area would be some smaller percentage of that number.
But again, if it's not, if the payment schedule, the cycle for paying the local governments may not be affected because they may not have gotten it anyway earlier than that. So it might be different than that fund. Then, Senator Scoy, what about the sales tax on motor vehicles? Is that, what's the schedule on which that is paid? And Is that also an acceleration, and would that be undone by this bill?
Well, Madam Chair, I'm looking at the Minnesota Revenue statement here, and it doesn't list the motor vehicle excise tax
on
it.
So I'm very curious about that. Ms. McQuay.
Madam Chair and members, there are sort of accelerations or shifts that we've done in several areas of the budget at other points in time. This one in particular affects the general sales tax and the ones that would be directly affected by that, including the cigarette, tobacco, alcohol, and then the natural resources. I'm not aware of the if there is any acceleration for the motor vehicle sales tax, but that would affect the highway user distribution fund and the transit fund and not the general fund. So that would
Mr. Chairman, I think it behooves us to find out from the department what how the mechanism and the timing for the motor vehicle sales tax is in a different statute, but automobile entities, sellers might be very interested in what that would mean for them. And I was thinking about that because of Senator Dame's bill the other day about what if you relieved used motor vehicles from the sales tax, that was almost in and of itself half a billion dollars. So it'd be interesting to know what the impact would be if indeed, number one, they do pay it in to the state on an accelerated basis, and number two, if that was also relieved, what the impact of it would be. I just think, I don't know if we can do that, but it would seem to me to be a good piece of information to have.
Madam Chair, I think we should first find out if it indeed was accelerated.
Yes.
And if it was, then we can look and see what the time frame impacts are.
Okay, those are my questions. Any other questions or comments? Senator Gazelka.
Mrs. Chair, I'm hoping that we can have some comments. I have a question for Bruce Newstead.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes, there's testifiers.
Yes. There's a testifier sitting right behind you, Senator Scoy. Mr. Newstead.
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record, and you know if you know the answer to my question, or at least have a general appreciation, or give us a general appreciation for that. That would be welcomed information.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Newstead.
My name is Bruce Newstead. I represent the members of the Minnesota Retailers Association. As the name suggests, we're a group of retailers across the state from the Oofta Shop in Red Wing up to Norby's Department Store in Detroit Lakes. I appreciate the opportunity to appear today. Madam Chair, on your question of timing, what we've been told in the past on the local impact is that based on the remittance schedule that the state has with the localities, they don't accelerate that local. They don't turn that payment to the localities around in those 2 days where they get the money early, so that impact is negligible. In fact, I believe the department's told us that they wait to remedy that until they have the final filing for June. I don't know the answer, though, to your MVES question, your motor vehicle sales tax question. Okay. That's a good one.
Okay. Did you have further testimony
Bill? I want to thank the committee for its work in this area. We know that the price tag for a full repeal is quite high, but we appreciate the committee taking a look at it. We really do appreciate the work that the committee did last year. If you look at the numbers, the threshold of $250,000 to change from $120,000 to $250,000 is fairly significant, and fairly significant for a lot of the businesses in your district. You don't have to sell many more than 20 TVs or vacuum cleaners or sofas at $500 a day to reach $3.6 million, which is your threshold for remitting the $250,000. So we appreciate the work that the committee's done in the past. I think there's maybe still some work that you can do to help, especially some of those Main Street retailers that happen to sell 20 vacuum cleaners a month. So we appreciate it. Thanks for your consideration of this. And we just ask that you continue to try to whittle away at it if you can't do a full repeal. It certainly does make a difference from a cash flow perspective. Back in 95, essentially what we did was change the state's cash flow problem and push it onto private businesses, which we've lived with that for a great number of years, but continue to appreciate any efforts that you can do to change that situation.
Senator Skoy.
Madam Chair, to the testifier, do the retailers have a preference if we're going to make a partial effort? Would you prefer us working on the income threshold or the amount that is accelerated?
Chair Skoy, do you mean the percentage or the threshold?
Yeah.
It's at 81 now.
Yeah, 81.4. I think that's a great question, actually. I think we'd love to have that conversation and take a look at it. You know, we have some precedents for moving around that percentage quite a bit. That's certainly one of the tools. If you were to ask me that today and said to me, Bruce, you have to answer, I'd say let's look at the dollar amount, the threshold dollar amount before the percentage. But I'm certainly open to looking at either.
Good. Thank you. Well, let's have a conversation.
Senator Skoy. Senator Gazelka.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one quick question. I've been asking this a number of times. I thought Senator Skoy was going to ask it, but if you look at, we've talked about business property tax relief, sales tax collection reimbursement, and now accelerated sales tax, how would you prioritize them about which is most important?
Thank you, Senator Gazelka. I was sort of hoping I wasn't going to be asked that today. that's a great question, and I think on vendor collection allowance or sales tax collection reimbursement, we don't exactly know how much that costs and what our final thresholds and percentages might be. Certainly a priority item. Many members on the statewide business property tax indicate that that is a priority item as well. This is certainly an important piece, too. So if you don't mind, I'd actually prefer not to rank those today, since I'm not sure that we have all the facts gathered together. I could say they're definitely all important, and but we realize that there's only so much available from a relief perspective. So happy to take a look at that.
Yeah, thank you.
I'll call on Senator Skoy, but I think all three of those are scalable. So we could make progress in each of those areas without having to say all or nothing, Senator Gazelka. Mm-hmm. Senator Skoy.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Gazelka, the other component of this that I would like to contemplate is the one-time nature of the expenditure. If you look at the impact on this, it's clearly one time. The other provisions have ongoing costs, so we'd have to take that into account and the impact on the tails.
Madam Chair, I saw that.
Senator
I just
Gazelka.
Thought if I can get more, that's good.
It's my favorite question of the year, Senator Gazelka.
Yeah. any other questions or comments for Senator Skoy? Then, as a practice in the full committee, the chair will lay over Senate File Number 8 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Here you go. The division will meet tomorrow at 8:30, and then the full committee again will meet on Thursday with bills dealing with mostly with policies regarding local government aids. If there's no further, Senator Reiner, if there's no further business before the committee, with the chair's permission, we stand adjourned.